college because of some music I was doing at basement parties with homeboys named Jazz and Ready Rock. Our hopes had finally collided. And these hopes were inherently incompatible with each other. One had to give way. One of us was going to have our heart broken. The thing I've learned over the years about advice is that no one can accurately predict the future, but we all think we can. So advice at its best is one person's limited perspective of the infinite possibilities before you. People's advice is based on their fears, their experiences, their prejudices. And at the end of the day, their advice is just that. It's theirs, not yours. When people give you advice, they're basing it on what they would do, what they can perceive, and what they think you can do. But the bottom line is, while yes, it is true that we're all subject to a series of universal laws, patterns, tides, and currents, all of which are somewhat predictable, you are the first time you've ever happened. You and now are a unique occurrence of which you are the most reliable measure of all the possibilities. I've always loved the scene in The Pursuit of Happiness on the basketball court in which Jaden's character shoots the ball and yells, "I'm going pro!" My character, Chris Gardner, discourages him from pursuing basketball but catches himself. Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. Not even me. You got a dream, you got to protect it. People can't do something themselves, they want to tell you you can't do it. If you want something, go get it. Period. My mother's college education saved her life, which solidified for her a fundamental premise. A college education is the only armor against the brutality of this world. And without a college education, I would be condemned to certain destruction. This was not her advice to me. This was the truth. To her, being a rapper was impossible. But I am not my mother. Just as her education saved and defended her from the hardships of her early life, performance and hip-hop had saved me from mine. It's clearer when I look back now. While we were gridlocked and colliding and arguing, the reality was both things were true. One was true for her, and the other was true for me. But at the time, neither of us could compromise because it would mean destroying everything we stood for. Daddy-O was caught in the middle. My mom was demanding that he make me go to college, and I was begging him to please understand what I was saying. It was clear that he was going to have the final word. Daddy-O was going to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner of the hopes and dreams of either his wife or his son. Daddy-O deliberated for about a week. He would take me for a drive, my mom for a walk. He'd ask questions and listen to us talk. In the meantime, Woodcrest was as cold as the ice house. My mother and I were cordial. We kept it on high and by. And then one evening, Daddy-O called us both into the kitchen. My mother and I sat at the table, and Daddy-O leaned against the stove. Daddy-O had been here before, except last time he was sitting in my seat when he was being told by his parents what he could and couldn't do, when he had so loved his camera, but he'd been told that it was just a hobby, not a career. At his heart, Daddy-O was an artist who had been robbed of his dreams and his passions because they were unrealistic and impractical. But he also knew firsthand the viciousness of this world against an uneducated black kid. Everything Daddy-O ever did, somebody had told him he couldn't do it. He was supposed to get a job because there was no way he could start his own business. People told him there was no way white people would work for him. There was no way real supermarkets would buy ice from a black man. He lived against a ferocious headwind of doubt and discouragement, but he did it all anyway. "So here's what we're going to do," Daddy-O said. "You got 1 year. Your mother says she can get all them schools to hold your acceptance till next September. We're going to help you and support you to do anything you think you need to do to succeed. But in 1 year, if it ain't happening, you going to whichever one of them schools your mother choose. That work for you?" In my mind, a year was forever. I was ecstatic. He turned to my mom. "That work for you?" My mom clearly didn't love it, but this was a compromise that kept her dreams alive. She only said one word. "Yep." And with that, Daddy-O went back to work. My experiences with my father are a mixed bag, to say the least. But that night, in the kitchen, at 5943 Woodcrest Avenue, he displayed the most exquisite leadership I had ever seen. That was how a father was supposed to be. A few weeks later, my mother called the dean at the University of Wisconsin, a school where my application had been accepted. She told the dean everything. "It's terrible," she said. "My son wants to take a gap year. He's doing something called rapping. He's got a manager and some company is paying him to record an album. It all sounds suspect to me, but we were wondering if you could hold his place until September 87. The dean listened patiently. "I think that's incredible, Mrs. Smith."
"What?"
my mom said. "For a young man his age, he would never get that kind of life experience here. He should absolutely do it." My mother was floored. "And certainly we'll hold a spot for him. If his album doesn't work out, he can attend next year. That's no problem." A few weeks later, in early May, about a month before my graduation, I was bagging ice at ACRAC. And in case you were wondering, bagging ice is just as dull and monotonous as it sounds. And you always hurt your back. The aluminum scoop held about 4 pounds of ice, 2.5 scoops into a 10-pound bag, which you would then spin to twist the top and then drop it into the tie machine, then toss the bag into the shopping cart. If you stacked them correctly, you could get about 24 bags into one shopping cart. Then you roll the cart into the walk-in freezer. You take the bags out one at a time and stack them. In a 4-hour session, one person could do 200 to 250 bags. It's repetitive, and you just kind of zone out for a few hours while you do it. I always like to do it at night because that's when Power 99 played hip hop. I'd listen to the Power 9 at 9 countdown, getting lost in my own world and staying up on the new hip hop joints. I would rap along, memorizing my favorite songs and shovel on beat, inventing my own rhymes. But that night, I was quiet. For the first time, I understood the old saying, "Be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it." I had held my ground against my parents, and they gave in. But now, I had to prove it.
Hey, it's your girl, Lady B. Coming in at number 5, it's Kumo D's brand new track, Go See the Doctor.
I was walking down the street, rocking my beat.
I'm as good as Kumo D, I thought, trying to psych myself up. But my mom had gotten into my head. What if she's right? What if a rapper isn't really a thing? And only 1 year? Is that enough? This last year just blazed by. Maybe I should go to college. I did do all this with Jeff while I went to high school. Maybe I could go to college and still do music. Scoop, bag, scoop, bag, scoop, bag. I'm not trying to be living at home. I need my own spot, my own money, my own car.
Number 4, the Beastie Boys are back with Hold It Now, Hit It.
Damn right about now.
And I would chill, wheel, ill, wait, stop. Chill, wait, I feel my
scoop, bag, scoop, bag. Man, I'm definitely as good as the Beastie Boys. Except they're on the radio and I'm bagging ice. Maybe bagging ice is my destiny. But man, if I'm stuck here with Daddy-O in 10 years, I'ma sever my own head with the dull end of this ice scoop. I mean, Run DMC and the Beastie Boys had to have their own versions of bagging ice, right? Or maybe they were flukes, like one in a million.
Number three.
My rhyme.
But I'm one in a million. Jeff's one in a million. My mom is not my target audience. How she thinks she gonna tell if a rapper is good or not? She judging stuff she don't even understand. And what about Melanie? You cannot keep a girlfriend if you running off to some college somewhere. She'll be tossed up with some other joker in 2 weeks. Scoop, bag, scoop, bag.
And we're back with number two. It's your girl's old favorite. That's right. My boys Run DMC and my Adidas.
This was my jam. It snapped me out of my funk. I was back to shoveling on beat and rapping along. My shoveling picked up pace completely involuntarily. That's the power of hip-hop, I thought.
My Adidas touched sand up a foreign land. With mic in hand, I cold took command.
But my reverie was short-lived. I couldn't get my mind off my mom. I'd failed to protect her from Daddy-O. I wasn't brave enough to go with her when she left. And now, the hope she had for me, the dreams that had sustained her through all her pain and trouble, I was spitting in the face of that. I couldn't shake the sense that I was failing her again. My Adidas finished playing and Power 99 went to a commercial break. I realized I had missed the end of the song. Damn, I thought. Not even my Adidas could pull me out of this one. I rolled the final cart into the freezer. I was done for the night. I counted the bags while commercials blared. New mattress sales. Everything must go. Maybe I could sell mattresses, I thought. That shit can't be hard. I could do hip-hop mattress raps. Get a good night rest, good sleep routines. Got twins and fools, got kings and queens. I threw the shovel on the side, closed the machines up.
And we're back tonight with a newcomer to the countdown.
Shutting off the lights, I realized I couldn't find my keys. I'd lost my keys a few times before, and Daddy-O had to come pick me up. I was dreading the thought of having to call him to come and get me. Here I am demanding my independence, about to have to call my daddy to pick me up because I can't find my damn keys.
The phones have been off the hook all day from y'all wanting to hear these guys. So get ready for our hometown boys, Philly's very own DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. This is Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble.
Listen, homeboys, don't mean to bust your bubble.
I totally froze. My mouth was hanging open.
Just last week,
my heart was pounding. I wanted to scream, I wanted to jump, but at the same time, I didn't want to do anything to bump into the universe and knock my record off the radio. That was me, on the radio, me, my rhymes, my voice. I wanted to call people, but I didn't want to miss it. I ran outside, I wanted to grab somebody, to tell somebody, that's me, y'all, that's me on the radio. But it was 10 o'clock and nobody was out there. I started giggling, a knee-jerk reaction that I still have to this day when I find myself in extreme emotional circumstances. I could not stop laughing. It was a joyous, blissful laughter, the pure joy of a child waking up on Christmas morning, the joy of discovery, of renewed hope, of a new life, the joy of being right about me. Chapter 6, Ignorance. We didn't know shit. The tour bus pulled up on Woodcrest. We'd all agreed we'd meet at my house because my street was the widest. My whole family assembled to see us off. My mom, Daddy-O, Gigi, Ellen, Harry, Pam was home now too. But Melanie said she couldn't bear to see me drive away. We had said our goodbyes the night before. The neighborhood kids had never seen a tour bus before, so they buzzed around, checking the tires, peering in the luggage bays, and talking to the driver. Somehow, Dana had done it. Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble lit up local radio in May 1986, finally. When it first came out in March, it had stumbled, but by late May, it caught fire. We were hearing that it was getting played in Delaware and New Jersey and even New York City. I graduated from high school in June, which meant I had an entire month as a senior with a hit record on the radio. That's too much power for one 17-year-old to have. As I ran off stage in my cap and gown, waving my diploma, I ran to hug my mom, but she jokingly refused to hug me, snatched the diploma out of my hand, and said, "Boy, this is mine." By July, Dana had me and Jeff locked in Studio 4 in downtown Philadelphia, recording our debut album, Rock the House. Because Jeff and I had been making songs since the day we met, we finished the album at light speed. But Dana kept messing with the songs, remixing and re-engineering them, and ultimately ruining the production. Our relationship with him was already souring, but we didn't have time to focus on that. We had a hit song, and we had to figure out how to capitalize on it right now. We did a few shows up and down the East Coast with LL Cool J and Houdini, including a couple of sold-out gigs in New York City. Then we booked our first full tour. We would be opening for Public Enemy and 2 Live Crew, two of the biggest hip-hop acts in the country at the time. We fed our luggage into the belly of the tour bus. My biological family ceremoniously presenting me unto my new hip-hop family. JL was the new father. He was the mature one. He was the adult in the room. He gave my mom and Daddy-O our itinerary, complete with bus routing, hotel names and phone numbers, venue addresses and dates, agents' names and contact info. JL was 21. He was the oldest. And my mom and Daddy-O were relieved he was in charge. Omar was the youngest. He was only 16. And even at that age, his fashion sense was fire. He always had the hottest gear and was the only person I'd ever known who traveled with an iron. Most groups had at least two dancers for the symmetry, but Omar's leg surgery had been so effective that we only needed him. He and I had grown up about 10 doors from each other. He had been a witness to most of the major events of my life so far. He had seen me through Raleigh choppers, cowboy boots. He'd bagged more than his share of ice. He'd even lied to me as I was being deposited into the back of an ambulance. "Oh yeah, man, definitely. You definitely dunked it." Omar wouldn't be graduating high school until next year, so JL had to walk up the street to his house to promise his mother that he would take responsibility for Omar getting his homework done and maintaining his honor roll status. Miss Brown, who had already played a key role in the naming of the Fresh Prince, had made this a condition of Omar's being allowed to go on tour with us. "Mrs. Rambert, you don't have to be concerned," JL said to Omar's mom. "I graduated from Overbrook. Will graduated from Overbrook, and I give you my word I will make sure that Omar graduates from Overbrook." Over the next year, JL helped Omar do his homework in hotel rooms, on tour buses, at rest stops, and they even missed our day at Six Flags over Georgia because of Pythagoras. Reddy Rock had stayed out partying the night before. He was exhausted. He threw his bags on the bus and was fast asleep in his bunk before we even pulled off. Jeff had just gotten brand new Anvil cases to transport his turntables, records, and beatboxes. At the time, because of my excitement, I didn't notice, but Jeff was quiet and to himself that day. In subsequent years, he would confide in us that because of his sheltered childhood, every time we would have to leave Philly, he suffered extreme anxiety attacks and other physical reactions. he would have 30 to 45 minute vomiting spells. But for the longest time, he never said a word. We had all decided that if we were going to be traveling around to all of these strange towns and cities, it would be unwise to go without security. And in the early days of hip hop, security was defined as your biggest and tallest friend who didn't smile. Ours was Charles Alston, aka Charlie Mack. Charlie Mack was raised in South Philly, one of the rougher sections of town. His parents were separated and he lived with his mom. They moved a lot during his early childhood until the chaos of his home life pushed him into the streets. Charlie started hustling on the corners when he was just 11 years old. Not too long after, he graduated to gun-toting and more serious drug dealing. By the time we met him, he was 6'7", almost 300 pounds, and nobody messed with Charlie Mack. He showed up that day with a green trash bag full of ones and fives. Clearly, the previous evening's revenues from his purveying of neighborhood pharmaceuticals. He had the trash bag slung over his shoulder like a ghetto-ass Santa Claus. "Charlie, you cannot walk around carrying a hefty bag full of cash," JL said.
"What you mean? What you mean? What you saying? I'm not going nowhere without my money," Charlie grumbled.
Charlie's voice is way too deep, and he speaks way too fast to be nearly 7 feet tall. And when he gets excited, he has no problem saying the same word or phrase as many times as necessary until you submit.
"My man, my man, my man, my man. And again, and again. Hold up, 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 hold up."
This will stop anybody in their tracks. The timbre and speed of repetition are barely comprehensible, but magically induce compliance on the part of the listener. So we let him calm down. Me, Jeff, and JL spoke to him later. We talked about our dreams and what we all hoped to build together. We offered Charlie a choice. He could continue to be a drug dealer, or he could take this shot with us to build real lives. We couldn't pay him as much as he could make on the streets, but when we could, we promised we would. Charlie paused. I could tell he was weighing the whole of his life. He had dreams too. And in some deep, hidden part of his soul, he knew he was living beneath himself. He had just needed someone to say it out loud.
"I think I could fuck with y'all," he said.
He ultimately devoted his life to DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. It would prove to be a commitment that was not without twists and turns. But one thing was true from that day on. He never sold drugs again. Bags are finally loaded. Everyone has said their goodbyes. The posse is mounted. I hug my family and step into the tour bus doorway. Three dirty rubber stairs, the threshold into my new life. A stargate, the portal out of my childhood and into the infinitely unknowable, on my own, where Daddy-O could no longer hurt me, but he could no longer protect me either. Away from the shame of failing my mother, away from the fear in her eyes that seemed to say, "He's ruining his life." As the doors began to close, I caught eyes with Gigi. She smiled that smile I'd seen in Resurrection Baptist Church every single Sunday of my life. "Just remember, lover boy," she said, "be nice to everybody you pass on your way up, because you just might have to pass them again on your way down." The sun was setting as our bus rattled across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Pennsylvania had turned into Delaware. Delaware had turned into Maryland. And the initial excitement had settled. The hum of the road lulled my heart into a reverie. The thought washed over me. I am in charge now. I had never been in love like I was with Melanie Parker. I wanted to build a life for us, to shield her from the chaos in the world. I wanted to do it right. from the time I was 5 years old. I always wanted to be married. I wanted my own family. Even my childhood games with my siblings. We used to play white family. Ellen was Kathy, Harry was Dickie, and I was Junior. Later, my fantasies as a teenager never involved having multiple girlfriends or wild orgies. My fantasies always involved one woman. I wanted to ravish her with my complete, undivided devotion and affection. I wanted to be the best man she's ever known. I wanted to fulfill all of her dreams, solve all of her problems, take away all of her pain. I wanted her to adore me. I wanted to be so trustworthy and emotionally reliable that I would cleanse her impression of all men. And if I could have killed a dragon for her, climbed up her hair, entered the heavily guarded castle, and then have my kiss work as an antidote to the poison she'd ingested, that would have just been a little icing on my love cake. I was 18. From the day I met her, Melanie had been the center of my life. Healing the pain of her trauma became my constant preoccupation. The look in Melanie's eyes became the substitute for Gigi's approval. I've always needed a woman to achieve for. When I performed, I was now performing for Melanie. When I started making money rapping, in my mind, I was making money for her. I bound my self-esteem to the sliding scale of her happiness. If she was happy, that meant I was a good person. If she was unhappy, that meant I was a monster. We arrived in Tallahassee on the first leg of our southern run. The rest of the guys would go to the venue early to set up and sound check. And because all I had to do was rap, I could arrive 45 minutes before showtime. On that first night, I walked into the dressing room to find the whole squad sitting around with six or seven girls, Jordache jeans and bamboo earrings everywhere. The dressing room smelled like the perfume section of a merry-go-round. I politely asked Keisha, Mercedes, and Cinnamon and them to leave, and I called a crew meeting. "We got to get these rules straight," I said. "I don't want no girls in the dressing rooms. No girls on the bus, and whatever floor we stand on in the hotel, I don't want no girls there either. I don't want to be smelling no perfume and hearing no giggling and shit. I'm in love with Melanie. We're in a relationship, and I'm not out here for no foolishness." The guys all kind of looked at one another as if to say, "He can't be serious." Reddy Rock raised his hand, and I pointed to him. "What, man?" Reddy Rock, somewhat confused, said, "So where are we supposed to fuck all the groupies at?" "Hopefully you'll be fucking them behind that preposition," I said.
"Will, this crazy man," Charlie said. You're not out here by yourself. This is all of us. How you making lateral decisions?"
"Look, man, I'm about to propose to this girl. We're getting married. And I am not messing it up because of a bunch of horny-ass ghetto hyenas."
"Big bro, I respect that you're in love and all that," Omar said. "But that don't make me no hyena."
I was going full choir boy, and the guys didn't like it at all. But when my mind locks onto an idea, when I commit to a system of beliefs, there are only two options. One, I complete my mission. Or two, I'm dead. We didn't know shit. We didn't realize you had to pay the bus driver yourself, and if you didn't, he might just go home. We didn't know that some venues would skim money off the top, that they'd lie to you about how many tickets they'd sold. We didn't know that unruly audiences would throw things at you on stage if they didn't like you. Pennies, bottles, batteries, shoes, and even an M80 explosive in Oakland one night. We didn't know that there were all kinds of curfew laws and union rules in different states that meant your show would get shut down if you didn't shut up and get off stage quick enough. We didn't know that you had to grease the security guys at the venue if you didn't want your stuff to come up missing.
we didn't realize that 1 inch on a map could equal 12 hours on a tour bus. People often say ignorance is bliss. Maybe. Right up until it's not. We punish ourselves for not knowing. We always complain about what we could and should have done and how much of a mistake it was that we did that thing, that unforgivable thing. We beat on ourselves for being so stupid, regretting our choices and lamenting the horrible decisions we make. But here's the reality. That's what life is. Living is the journey from not knowing to knowing, from not understanding to understanding, from confusion to clarity. By universal design, you are born into a perplexing situation, bewildered, and you have one job as a human. Figure this shit out. Life is learning, period. Overcoming ignorance is the whole point of the journey. You're not supposed to know at the beginning. The whole point of venturing into uncertainty is to bring light to the darkness of our ignorance. I heard a great saying once, life is like school with one key difference. In school, you get the lesson and then you take the test. But in life, you get the test and it's your job to take the lesson. We're all waiting until we have deep knowledge, wisdom, and a sense of certainty before we venture forth. But we've got it backward. Venturing forth is how we gain the knowledge. Over the next few years, while our ignorance would rain down a deluge of pain and suffering, when I look back, I see clearly it could have been no other way. The universe only teaches through experience. So even when you haven't the slightest clue what you're doing, you just have to take a deep breath and get on the damn bus. You could not have found three more different groups to put on the same stage than DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Public Enemy, and 2 Live Crew. But hip hop was like that back then. I found myself studying the audience even more than the performers. We were all tapping into totally different aspects of the human spirit. Public Enemy would ignite social consciousness. People would stomp and yell and cheer, venting their dissatisfaction with authority. I noticed how the security energy in the building, particularly in the South, would heighten as Chuck D riled the audience to rail against our shared sense of injustice. As a part of their show, they had a stuntman dress up as a Ku Klux Klan member. They played out a scene in which he was sentenced for his crimes against humanity. And then, in the most shocking moment of their entire show, they put a noose around his neck and hung him on stage. For 30 seconds, his body jerking and convulsing in midair while the crowd watched until his last shudder. And then silence, his lifeless body swinging above center stage. And then,
Biggie, 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 yes! The rhythm, the rebel!
Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard
Chuck D would drop into Rebel Without a Pause and chaos and pandemonium was unleashed. And while I have experienced other performers who have matched the level of intensity Public Enemy could conjure, I have never seen it surpassed. 2 Live Crew tapped into an entirely different kind of energy. Luther Campbell, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker, or Uncle Luke, came out on stage and screamed to the crowd, "Hey!" And 15,000 people screamed, "We want some pussy!" Including the probably 8,000 women in attendance. I still haven't totally figured that one out. We had never heard of Two Live Crew, yet in Florida, they were the headliner. Their hit single was called We Want Some Pussy. They were giving the crowd permission to unleash, at least verbally, their inner hyenas. This was further amplified by the simulated lewd sex acts they included in their shows. And if I can keep it real, some nights they just skipped the simulated part. But what really caught my attention was how smart everybody was. This was an era when authority, be it government, business, law enforcement, even many parents, was skeptical and fearful of the growing influence of hip-hop and hip-hop artists. Rap concerts were met with stringent scrutiny, particularly when we toured through southern states. When you're on tour with Public Enemy and Two Live Crew in Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Alabama, rest assured your ass was going to get stringently scrutinized. Before the concerts in the South, there were always meetings with the local sheriffs and chiefs of police to inform us of the local laws and statutes that governed the behavior that would be tolerated on stage. We were informed that any infringement would lead to an immediate ending of the show, and we would be forcibly pulled off stage and arrested. Needless to say, both public fellatio and hanging a Klansman were frowned upon in Mississippi. Given the high stakes, these meetings would inevitably escalate into social debate and legal interpretation. Chuck D knew the law. He had local advocates, community leaders, and legal scholars arming him with the counterarguments and information necessary to defend his First Amendment rights. And when all else failed, he had bail money pre-organized. But what was not going to happen was some local sheriff telling him he couldn't perform his show exactly the way he wanted to perform it. He hung a Klansman every single night on that tour. Luke Skywalker, on the other hand, wanted to get arrested. He saw it as supremely effective publicity. Uncle Luke was a brilliant entrepreneur. He owned his own record company, distributor, agency, and merchandising group. Not to mention barbershops, supermarkets, and nightclubs. He hadn't yet worked out how to expand his businesses beyond his regional foothold. But he knew that if he got arrested in Macon, Georgia, that Baton Rouge and Shreveport, Louisiana would sell out within 24 hours of the headline. And on top of it, he had a perfectly lovely time on stage. He was also well aware of the growing national and international spotlight that was shining on the question of art versus morality. At the time, Tipper Gore, then the wife of Senator Al Gore, was leading the charge against profanity in entertainment. Back then, FCC rules forbade broadcasting profanity, and Two Live Crew didn't have a single record that didn't have profanity in it. Even record store owners were getting arrested for crimes of obscenity for selling their albums. So Uncle Luke got a boat, built a radio station on it, and kept it offshore in international waters where he could legally broadcast back to the mainland. Luke saw Two Live Crew being at the explosive center of this battle, and he aimed to harness this fuel to expand his business globally. Eventually, the U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that rap was protected by the First Amendment. More than 20 years later, Luther Campbell ended up running for mayor of Miami-Dade County. I remember sitting in those meetings wanting to raise my hand so bad and say, "Excuse me, Mr. Sheriff, Officer, sir, you don't need to look at me because my grandmother agrees with you. But honestly, you could probably just arrest them right now, because Chuck is definitely going to hang a Klansman tonight, and Luke never gets past the first chorus before his balls are all the way out." I don't remember JL speaking once in any of those meetings. Instead, he filled legal pads with notes. He studied every single word. He later went back to research the statutes. He met with Public Enemy's managers, made friends with the tour promoters, picked Luke Skywalker's brain about major labels versus self-distribution.
JL spent less and less time going with us sightseeing to clubs or to amusement parks, and more time studying the music business from any and every angle. Touring had opened our eyes to the industry and the intricacies of how it actually worked. Public Enemy had a management company, accountants, A&R reps, and road managers. We just had JL. Word Up Records, Dana's record label, still didn't have any other artists signed to it. Dana didn't tell us how many records we sold. Our record still wasn't available in any stores outside Philly. But the breaking point for me happened when we found out that Dana had not been returning calls from Russell Simmons. Back then, Russell was arguably the single most important person in the hip-hop world. He'd been representing artists and producing records since 1977. He co-founded Def Jam Records, the biggest hip-hop label in the 80s. And he had groomed, managed, and produced all the biggest acts, such as the Beastie Boys, Run-DMC, LL Cool J, and Houdini. Apparently, Russell had been trying to contact us for months already, but none of his messages were getting to us because he was trying to reach us through Dana. We were pissed. Russell absolutely loved DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. He was raving about the first line of Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble, where I say, "Oh man, my eye. Man, this guy just walked up to me and punched me in my eye, man, talking about I was just trying to talk to his girl. Man, I don't even know her, man." "That's the illest shit I ever heard," Russell said. "What rapper admits they got punched in the eye?" Russell recognized our honesty, vulnerability, and self-deprecating humor, unheard of in hip-hop at the time, as a passport to places rappers had never gone. Russell wanted to work with us. Unfortunately, Dana refused to talk to him. I've always marveled at JL's and Dana's opposite reactions to Russell's enthusiasm. Whereas Dana was threatened by Russell's interests, JL saw Russ as a potential teacher and a gateway to new opportunities. And JL had a plan. Even though Dana controlled the recording of our music, JL controlled the management of our career. He agreed to turn over the management of DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince to Russell Simmons and Lior Cohen at Rush Management under three conditions. One, they would put Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince on tour with their biggest acts. Two, they would hire JL to oversee our account. And three, they would teach JL the business. Russell agreed. It's so painful when people I care about miss the opportunity to elevate. I've been in this kind of situation maybe 50 times in my career. I am trying to climb and fly as high as humanly possible. And I want to take the people I love with me. But invariably, at critical moments, when the necessity to level up presents itself, some people, like JL, rise to the occasion, and others fold. Whether they don't see the grander vision or can't take the heat of the fresh challenge or they're trapped by some hidden, self-defeating narrative, over and over, I have suffered the pain of waving from the bow of the new ship as they're left behind, standing on the shore. "You got to get us out of this Dana deal," I said to JL. "It doesn't work like that," JL said. "So he can just hold us back and there's nothing we can do? Doesn't he have some legal responsibility?" "He has a contract," JL said. "You just make the records, let me figure this out." Hip hop was now a global business, and DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince were primed to be packaged and sold to the world. We needed national and global distribution. Jive Records was based out of London. Jive would later become famous for masterminding the careers of Britney Spears, NSYNC, and Backstreet Boys. But back in the 80s, they were the biggest hip-hop label in Europe. With Dana controlling our record in the United States, JL orchestrated an international distribution deal with Jive to sell Rock the House overseas. Jive hired Dana's Word Up Records to be the official distributor of DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince in the United States. On the surface, this appeared to be an easy win for Dana. He'd get to keep selling our records in the States, while we'd gain a bigger profile worldwide and go into the studio on Jive's dime. Basically, Jive would cover all costs, but Dana would still get a revenue stream at home. Dana couldn't wait to sign that contract. Dana got a big check and sold our international rights to Jive. Jive immediately remastered and re-released Rock the House in March 1987. With a new cover and a new burst of energy, it became a significant global hit. They were also able to sell this new version as an import into the United States. Dana realized that he had opted for a one-time payment instead of a royalty, and he could do nothing about the imports. So he demanded more money and threatened to refuse all cooperation with Jive. A legal battle ensued. And as soon as the lawyers started digging into our paperwork, they figured out that I had been 17 when I signed my contract with Dana. Under Pennsylvania law, anyone under the age of 18 cannot legally sign a contract without a parent or guardian present. I had signed mine in the lobby of a studio before a recording session. Therefore, in legal terms, our contract with Dana never existed. Just like that, Dana Goodman was out of the DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince business. Dana was furious. At first, he blamed Jive and Russell Simmons, but lacking the lawyers and money to go after them, he decided to exact revenge on the next best thing, me. People in the neighborhood started pulling me up. "Hey man, Dana's really upset. Just watch your back." Then, one night, he pulled up outside our house, parked his car on the street, and just sat there. I was terrified, but Daddy-O never flinched. Not saying a word, he opened the front door, walked up to Dana's car, and leaned down into the open passenger side window. Daddy-O saw a gun on the dashboard. "Can I help you?" Daddy-O said. "Where's that motherfucker at?" Dana gruffly responded. "Well, if the motherfucker you looking for is Will, he's in the house. You're welcome to come in and kill him now. And the whole family's home, too. Because if you touch Will, you're going to have to kill us all. But we ain't accepting no fucking threats from you." Daddy-O immediately turned his back on a man who could easily have shot him and strolled into the house. I'm not sure if it was his military training or his upbringing on the streets of North Philly, but he taught me a valuable lesson that day. It's better to die than to walk around scared. I was in the living room, peeking from behind the curtain. I watched as Dana put his car in drive and drove away. Chapter 7. Adventure. If this book were a movie, we've now reached the montage scene where the music kicks in. "For the Love of Money" by the OJs, and everything goes great. Our hero can't miss. He's on the come up. Every shot goes in, every kiss burns with the passion of a thousand suns. He can't get to the bank fast enough to cash all the checks. His name dances off the lips and rings in the ears of the high and the mighty. No longer emblazoned on the side of his pants, his moniker now bounces off his chest in 24-karat herringbone gold, littered with ethically sourced diamonds. It became clear in this year that he was never going to college. Our debut album, Rock the House, led by Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble as the first single, and now plugged into the international distribution system of Jive Records, ended up going gold, selling more than 500,000 copies, and would eventually reach number 83 on the Billboard 200 chart.
And while that wasn't necessarily considered earth-shattering at the time, Cinderella had made it to the ball. Now, I don't want to be the old guy at the end of the bar yapping about how much better music was in his day, how these kids don't know nothing about real rap. There's actually brain science that theorizes that the songs you hear in your teenage years become embronzed in your emotional memory, heightening their nostalgic power beyond any other period in your life. That's not what's happening here. I get that that's what happens with other people, but this is not some dopamine-induced opinion, blinkered by wistful memories of a fairy tale adolescence. No. What I'm saying is objectively and factually true. The late 1980s was the greatest time in hip hop history, period, full stop, amen. Please be seated. Allow me to make my case. From the moment Jeff and I stepped on that tour bus in late 1986 through summer 1988, we performed nearly 200 shows. And I would like to list just a few of the hip-hop icons with whom we shared a stage. Imagine this in my trying not to be an asshole voice. Run-DMC, LL Cool J, Houdini, Public Enemy, 2 Live Crew, Salt-N-Pepa, Eric B. and Rakim, NWA, EPMD, UTFO, JJ Fad, Beastie Boys, The Ghetto Boys, Heavy D and the Boys, Sir Mix-a-Lot, Kid and Play, MC Light, Queen Latifah, Grandmaster Flash, Ice-T, Mantronics and Just Ice, Eazy-E, Too Short, MC Hammer, Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick, Big Daddy Kane, Biz Markie, Roxanne Shanté, MC Shan and the whole Juice Crew, A Tribe Called Quest, Leaders of the New School, Naughty by Nature. Shall I continue or we good? This was one of the greatest periods of my life. Everything was new. We were defining the culture. We were part of the wave, the tsunami that was carrying hip-hop across the globe. Every artist was unique. Something happened every show that was a first in hip-hop. We were playing in front of crowds where sometimes 50% of the audience had never seen someone rap before. They were in awe. There was an intoxicating energy of discovery and adventure. This was a time in my life rich with first encounters and mind-expanding new experiences. The executive who ran our account at Jive was a Japanese woman named Ann Carley. At first, Jeff and I were a little confused at how she was going to direct our careers. And then she spoke. She had been at the heart of the initial bursts of hip-hop in New York City. She fed Jeff and me a global diet of the world's hip-hop colorings. I could feel my spirit of adventure awakening. I discovered the vital importance of travel. It lends critical perspective. Things that had been debilitating problems in my mind on the streets of West Philly barely existed in a rodeo arena in Omaha, Nebraska. I made a promise to myself that I would eat anything that the locals ate. I've eaten blackened alligator, sea slugs, camel, and chocolate-covered crickets. Everything tastes like chicken. It doesn't. I just always wanted to say that. I wanted to see and do everything. On the back of the moderate but solid success of Rock the House, Jive Records was eager for us to record a follow-up album as soon as possible. In the fall of 1987, our first ever trip out of the United States was scheduled. 6 weeks in London, where Jive was headquartered, to record in their company studios. But 2 weeks prior to our departure date, JL called me with that 1 a.m. phone call where even the tone of the ring makes your heart jump. Jeff was in a car accident, he said. Disoriented, I responded. What happened? Where is he? Is he cool? I don't know. I'm going to the hospital. I'll hit you back. Back then, there were no texts, no reaching people in their cars, no minute-to-minute reports on how your loved ones were doing. You just made sure everybody stayed off the landline. You kept checking the phone for a dial tone, and you waited. And the longer you waited, the more graphic and disturbing the pictures your mind painted, until you were absolutely certain that you'd never see them again. At about 3:15 a.m., the phone rang again. This time, the ring was louder than it should have been, like it was ringing at me instead of for me. I answered. "Yo." "He's cool," JL said. "His right leg is broken, and he has a cast from his hip to his ankle. Other than that, he's fine. But the doctor said he shouldn't fly. We need to postpone the trip for about 8 weeks. In the background, I heard Jeff scream out, "I don't give a fuck what that doctor say. In 2 weeks, I'm gonna be on a plane to London." And true to his determined spirit, 2 weeks later, we were checking into the Holiday Inn Swiss Cottage. It was me and Charlie in one tiny cramped-ass hotel room, and JL Reddy Rock and Jeff and his full-length cast in another. Just five Philly kids, dreary English days, and dank English nights, but a private recording studio set aside just for us on Jive's dime. We spent more than a month in London, and I couldn't have told you a single thing about the city. We didn't walk through Hyde Park or visit Westminster Abbey. We didn't see Buckingham Palace or climb the Tower of London. We didn't sit in a 1,000-year-old pub and eat fish and chips, and we sure as hell didn't go to no soccer match. We never even adjusted from our jet lag. We woke up at 4 p.m. every day, hit the studio by 6 p.m., worked until about 6 a.m., grabbed some free breakfast from the Swiss Cottage buffet, and went to bed around 7 a.m. We kept that schedule up for almost 6 weeks, and it was bliss. Well, except for the one night that Jeff decided he wanted his cast taken off. His 6-week appointment to have it removed fell while we were in London, and his leg was starting to itch, but he didn't trust Britain's National Health Service to take it off. He was more comfortable if me and Charlie Mack did it. As a general rule, if someone asks me if I can do something, the answer is always yes, a delusional trait that both Charlie Mack and I share wholeheartedly.
"It's a cast, I'm saying, it's just a cast. Let's just take it off, it's a cast," Charlie said indifferently.
I too felt confident in the basic simplicity of the operation. It was just a cast. I called room service and requested a steak knife. Little did I know that British hotels didn't carry steak knives. This would make the process of cutting a piece of steak far too easy for them. Undeterred, I said, "Well, can you send up 30 butter knives, please?" The Swiss Cottage butter knives had a tiny serrated edge at the tip, which suggests that they weren't actually butter knives. My plan was I would give Charlie 15 knives, and he would begin cutting at Jeff's ankle, and I would take 15 knives and start cutting at Jeff's hip. The way the math played out in my mind, by the time we'd worn out the serrated edges of the butter knives, we should have met at Jeff's knee for a quick high-five celebration before making the last ceremonial cut. I had a vague memory that this two-ended, meet-in-the-middle process was successfully employed in the building of the Panama Canal and equally in the construction of the United States railroad system. The cutting began, or the lack thereof. Butter knife after butter knife bent and fell, as confusion grew into frustration on Charlie's sweat-moistened face.
"Yo, these knives ain't doing shit," he said.
I was 12 years old the last time I'd had a cast, and at the time they were made of plaster of Paris. Apparently cast science had advanced since then, and Jeff's was made out of some new alien material that later I learned was fiberglass. About 6 knives in, I called a halt. Undeterred, I suggested that Jeff get into the bathtub. We'd make the water as hot as he could take it, thereby softening this puppy up. I assured Jeff it would come right off, he agreed. Me and Charlie helped Jeff into the bathtub, both legs fully submerged, and then we waited. Pretty soon, a look of concern washed over Jeff's face.
Yo, man, y'all need to get this shit off. It's tightening up, Jeff said.
I remember thinking, what would MacGyver do? MacGyver was a hit 1980s TV show where the lead character, Angus MacGyver, would get into all kinds of predicaments only to come up with some ingenious solution. As I was attempting to channel my inner Mac, I heard the door to the hotel room open. A few seconds later, JL pokes his head into the bathroom. By this point, Jeff is squirming and moaning in the bathtub while Charlie Mack and I are on our knees holding two butter knives with 28 others scattered all over the bathroom floor. JL takes a long pause, presumably trying to puzzle out what he's seeing. Stumped, he shouts, what the fuck are y'all doing?
JL, JL, Jeff squealed. You got to get this shit off my leg.
Why are you in the tub? JL had spent the previous 2 years working at a hospital, so while it was not his expertise either, he at least knew that you don't soak a fiberglass cast in hot water while it's still on somebody's leg.
You can't get that cast wet like that!
Just get it off, y'all, Jeff wailed.
Stop bitching, man. It can't be that bad, Charlie said.
Get him out of the goddamn tub, JL barked.
You don't need to be yelling at us, JL. That don't help shit, Charlie snapped back.
Me and Charlie got Jeff out of the tub as instructed and laid him on the bathroom floor. We had been keeping canned foods in our hotel rooms because Swiss Cottage room service wasn't all it could have been. JL immediately went over and opened a can of beef stew. With the jagged edge of the aluminum lid, he came over to Jeff's cast, and whereas Charlie and I had been trying to cut vertically up and down the cast, JL made gentle horizontal moves across the cast, and like Grant through Richmond, in less than 90 seconds, he had made a full-length incision, which Charlie and I were able to easily pry fully open. Jeff was free. Angrily, JL threw the top of the beef stew can into the trash, and as he exited, he grumbled, "Y'all are stupid as shit." In medical scenarios, we may have been dumb and dumber, but in the studio, we were fire. Those recording sessions were probably the purest creative experiences I've ever had in my career. We recorded so many songs, and the record company loved so many of them that they decided to attempt something that had never before been tried in the world of rap. DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince would release hip hop's first double album. Jeff and I had no concept of what this album was going to do, whether it was something fans would want to hear, whether MTV would like it, whether radio stations would play it, whether hip hop heads would diss it. None of this even crossed our minds. All we cared about was that we were inspired and inflamed by the creative process. We were having fun. We were best friends at the center of our new family, and we were on the cutting edge of a burgeoning global art form. We were riding high. But in hindsight, imperceptible seeds of impending discontent were being sown. Some people thrive at high altitudes, but others can't breathe. And what do people do when they climb a mountain and realize the air is too thin? They try to get back down as fast as possible. Quincy Jones called it altitude sickness. In high school, Ready Rock and I had been best friends. We would ride around every single day battling and creating. We were inseparable. But as DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince began to take shape, human beatboxing was becoming less and less of a core art form within our group. The record company was also not interested in songs featuring human beatboxing. The result was that Clate was being pushed to the fringes of our new family. I was telling him not to worry. I got you, I said. In hindsight, it was too much change, too fast. And the experience demanded emotional maturity that was far beyond what any of us possessed. And to make matters even more painful and complicated, Charlie Mack and I were becoming locked at the hip. We weren't just sharing a hotel room together. We were sharing every aspect of our lives. There's even a song on the album celebrating my relationship with Charlie. Charlie Mack, The First Out the Limo. The song developed from Charlie's overdoing his security job. He would sit in the front of the limo with the driver, and he would be pissed if me or Jeff got out before he did. He would bark, "God damn it, y'all, let me secure the perimeter before y'all step out." There are no songs on the album about Ready Rock. From 1987 until 1990, I did not step outside without Charlie Mack with me. Whereas Jeff and JL were quiet, introspective homebodies, Charlie and I were loud, raucous, center of attention party starters. We were always looking for something to get ourselves into. We both loved to party. We loved to talk. We loved traveling and gambling and fast cars, and women loved us. Charlie not only matched, but also challenged my adventurous spirit. This joker never wanted to sleep. If we were only in a town for 10 hours, he didn't see any reason to spend a single minute in a hotel room. Many a day, he literally dragged me out of bed to go to Paisley Park in Minneapolis, or to go to hear a speech given by some activist in Chicago, or demand that we take a picture on the Strip, which is what Charlie calls the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
"Come on, man," he'd say. "You get to sleep all you want when you're dead."
The other part of our chemistry was that Charlie and I are both incredibly competitive and absolutely delusional in our high self-regard. We'd spend entire days arguing about who could run faster, who's a better driver, who could throw a football farther, who was more handsome, who was funnier, who was smarter, and most of all, which one girls liked more. Charlie absolutely hated it when a woman walked past him to flirt with me. He could not figure out why a woman would want to waste time with me if she could have him. He finally begrudgingly concluded,
"Man, the only reason girls want to get with you is because you're famous."
To which I replied, "Nah, Charlie, you got it backwards. I'm famous because all the girls want to get with me." We were the yin to each other's yang. We filled in the gaps in each other's life experience. We saw each other's blind spots and augmented each other's deficiencies. Charlie, like Daddy-O, had sharp streetwise instincts. He used to call it his ghetto radar. Charlie just knew when something bad was about to happen. We'd be out somewhere, everything would be going great, and out of nowhere, Charlie would whisper in my ear,
"Yo, man, let's go."
I'd be like, "What? Yo, we just got here." And then, more forcibly,
"Get up right now. I said, let's go."
I remember thinking that Charlie Mack was the human equivalent of an oversensitive smoke alarm that keeps going off at 2 a.m. when there's no fire. And because it's a smoke alarm, you can't ignore it, because one day there may actually be flames. But Charlie Mack was an infallible, perfectly calibrated hood smoke alarm. Every single time, I'd be grumbling in the parking lot as the sounds of gunshots rang out from the party we'd just left. We compensated for each other's weaknesses. Charlie knew the streets, and I understood broader emotional patterns. I was book smart and mainstream friendly. Whereas Charlie's physical appearance was scary and intimidating, I knew how to smile, make people feel safe, and get us in anywhere. Both of us were wildly deficient, but together we made one really capable person. I was Charlie's ticket into rooms into which he would never have been invited. And Charlie was the hammer that came down on anybody who dared to talk shit about me. He emboldened me to defend myself physically. Around this time, the chorus of criticism that I was corny and soft was beginning to rise. I didn't curse. I rapped about my high school experiences. I used a lot of humor. The shit talking was that I wasn't a real MC, or the worst, that I wasn't black enough and my music wasn't real hip hop.
Just punch a motherfucker in the face, Charlie would say. He won't say that shit next time.
So with him having my back, I started doing exactly that. If somebody talked shit, I punched him in the face and then jumped behind Charlie. He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper was released on March 29th, 1988, anchored by Brand New Funk and Parents Just Don't Understand. The album would eventually reach number 4 on the Billboard 200, going triple platinum, selling more than 3 million copies. What was so groundbreaking about the record was that Half was a DJ-centered tour de force, a scratch album in which Jeff absolutely massacred the Wheels of Steel. And the other half was the rapper side, where I was allowed to let the hyper-creative, poetic playfulness of my 19-year-old mind run wild. Then, the unimaginable happened. It was announced that the 31st Annual Grammy Awards would be the first to include a rap category, and Parents Just Don't Understand was nominated alongside Salt-N-Pepa's Push It, Going Back to Cali by LL Cool J, Kool Moe Dee's Wild Wild West, and Supersonic by JJ Fad. This was the first time I ever saw Jeff cry. I was excited beyond anything I'd ever experienced, but I'm not an accomplishment crier. I wasn't mature enough to ask back then, but I always wanted to know exactly what part of it was so emotional for Jeff. Was he thinking about his cancer as a child? Was it his mother and his musical family who had been reaching for this for so many years, and he was the one bringing this honor? Was he scared? Did he realize that there was no going back, that his old life was gone forever, and that the bar was now set so high? Charlie Mack, who had recently joined the Nation of Islam, said,
"This the will of God. Y'all aligned with the will of God. You won. I'm telling you, you won. None of them records gonna beat y'all record. What God ordains, no man contains. What God ordains, no man contains."
Charlie Mack had been speaking in spiritual rhymes for a few months now, but in pure Charlie Mack form, on February 22nd, 1989, Bobby McFerrin won Record of the Year for Don't Worry, Be Happy. Album of the Year was George Michael's Faith. Tracy Chapman won Best New Artist. And the winner for Best Rap Performance was DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince for Parents Just Don't Understand, making us the first rappers ever to receive a Grammy Award. We ultimately ended up boycotting the actual ceremony because NARIS, the Grammy committee, refused to televise the presentation of the Rap Award. We felt like that was a slap in the face. Rap music had outsold the industry that year. We deserved to be there. Russell Simmons and Lior Cohen organized the boycott for Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, along with Salt-N-Pepa, Ice-T, Public Enemy, Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick, Stetsasonic, and many others. And even though we weren't at the Grammys, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince were everywhere else. Life changed forever. Well, almost. Jeff's mom planned a celebration dinner for me and Jeff after our first American Music Award. We showed up on the block as returning hometown heroes. People were coming out of their houses to cheer and applaud and shake our hands. It took us 20 minutes to get into Jeff's mom's house. When we finally made it in, she threw her arms around us, gushing pride and joy. Then she handed Jeff $5 and a shopping list. "Jeffrey, I want you to go to the corner and get me some bread and some baking soda and see if they got them yams that come in a can." "But Mom," Jeff started. "But nothing, boy. Go get that stuff I told you to get." So DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince had to walk through our adoring fans up to Looney's. They didn't have the yams. Russell Simmons was orchestrating the global destruction of all barriers to hip-hop, and me and Jeff were one of his battering rams. We were the clean group, the respectable group. For Russell, we were the perfect weapon against all naysayers. We were at the tip of the spear. We launched YoMTV Raps, blasting hip-hop into daytime television. When the Four Seasons hotels would not allow rap artists to stay during their tours, Russell convinced them to allow DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, opening the doors for future hip-hop artists to use the chain. Daytime radio was terrified to put rappers on live, so they always forced rappers to pre-record interviews to make sure we didn't say anything crazy. Me and Jeff were among the first wave to be allowed to speak live on the radio during the day. Our shows were getting bigger, the crowds were getting louder. One night in Detroit at the Joe Louis Arena, I got overexcited and forgot the words to Parents Just Don't Understand. This had never happened to me before. My heart dropped into my stomach. There are few things more embarrassing than forgetting the words to the one song that 18,000 people spent their hard-earned money to come and hear. But something miraculous happened. The entire crowd began to sing the lyrics back to me. Every person knew every word. I held the mic out to the crowd and they finished the song. It took everything I had not to burst into tears. Thousands of people saying my words back to me. I felt loved, protected, and cradled by a crowd of strangers. We were red hot and unstoppable. At 20 years old, I was a world-famous rapper, a Grammy Award winner, and a freshly minted millionaire, pun intended. I would drop the mic, but I need it for the next chapter. For months, Gigi had been saving up to move to a 16th floor apartment overlooking the Main Line. It was a beautiful building set up for senior-friendly living. Her house on North 54th Street had become a burden for her. Too many stairs and generally inconvenient for her advancing years. With my first money, I surprised Gigi with the apartment she'd been saving up for. She had thought we were just going to look at it, but then the real estate agent handed her the keys. "Lover boy," she said with a gasp. "How'd you do this?" "Well, Gigi, there's this thing called rap music," I said, putting my arms around her. Melanie and I moved into Gigi's old house on North 54th Street. My childhood home was now our new home. I had promised Melanie that I would take care of her. And here I was, providing the first safe home of her short life. I'd won. All of my dreams were blossoming into vivid THX sound and Technicolor. I had conquered life. Chapter 8. Pain. He was light-skinned with light eyes. I hated dudes like that. I've always been intimidated by those Christopher Williams-looking jokers. Women have always shoulder-surfed right past me to gawk over Albie Shore or El DeBarge. I had just come home from a two-week run in the Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Portland, and a bunch of the little ones in between. I used to run right off stage into the car, straight to the airport to get back to Melanie as quickly as possible. I didn't want to leave any room for my inner hyena to grab the wheel and start the drunk drive through my life. I was meeting Melanie at her aunt's house. I had the car drop me off there directly from the airport. We were going to walk from her aunt's house to our new home. For old time's sake, we were going to pass Overbrook High and hit the Sugar Bowl convenience store for a water ice and a soft Philly pretzel, just as we'd done 1,000 times before. I always loved how much Melanie missed me, even weekend gigs. When I came home Monday morning, she acted like I'd been gone for months. She knew how to make a dude feel glad he was home. When I walked in after the Northwest trip, she and her aunt were in the kitchen cooking. just as they'd been so many times before. Being on the road can be excruciatingly lonely. It feels almost like it dehydrates your heart. Her aunt was in her usual dark blue hijab with her glasses way down on the tip of her nose so she could see into the pots. The smell of the food seemed to soften and quench my parched soul. Melanie was in one of her art smocks that doubled as an apron. I always thought that was weird. Paint is chemicals. That smock didn't belong in the kitchen. I looked at Melanie. Everything was the same, except something wasn't. Her energy was odd. Something was off. Because of my upbringing, it's almost as if I have a shock collar wrapped around my central nervous system. When I perceive that something is askew, that someone's external behavior is out of sync with what's going on in their heart and mind, my body experiences what I can best describe as a gradual rising electrical current. I feel a bzzz, and then it's like I'm shivering, but I'm not cold. The kitchen was hot, but I had chills. We sat down. We ate dinner. We talked about the neighbor's dogs. Melanie's aunt had once been to Portland. She didn't like that section of the country, too rainy. Melanie was laughing too much. Bzzz.